My name is Michael McCusker. Monday, November 11th, is Armistice 101. The next year, a century ago, amidst the worst influenza epidemic in history that killed millions around the world, the leaders of the victorious Allied nations of World War I, who defeated Kaiser Germany, met in Paris in January 1919. To discuss peace terms, more exactly to mete out punishments against Germany for having started the war. Germany was not invited. The killing of the war to end all wars stopped an hour before noon on November 11th, 1918, after four terrible years of bloodshed that almost destroyed European civilization. Much of Europe was in ruins, its economies devastated. Millions were dead and millions more were displaced, homeless, hungry, hopeless. Within a week of the armistice, the 28th President of the United States, Thomas Woodrow Wilson, boarded a ship named after the nation's first president to attend a peace conference at Versailles, France. Meeting there at the beginning of 1919 were the political leaders of the victorious Allies who had defeated the Central Powers of Germany and Austria. And Wilson, who thought of himself as a peacemaker, was determined to imprint the great new power of the United States upon the proceedings. After all, the USA had turned the balance of a brutal stalemate. The opposing armies were exhausted and decimated after more than 3 years of savagely modern warfare, and whichever side America chose to back with its fresh millions of soldiers would win. America had chosen the British and French over the Germans and Austrians, ostensibly in retort to Germany's unrestricted submarine warfare that sank ships with Americans aboard. Wilson was determined to make his already famous 14 points the basis of the peace treaty, in particular, the final point. The final point, number 14, was the most important to Wilson and the major reason he was in Europe against the advice of his Democratic Party back home. The formation of a general association of nations with the mission of preserving world peace, with mutual guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity to great and small nations alike. At last, to banish war, a dream of millions for millennia. This was Wilson's great dream. He campaigned for a second term as president in 1916 on a slogan that he had kept America out of the European war that had begun 2 years earlier. But in 1917, he sent American armies into the slaughter. Historian Garrett Mattingly, writing of an earlier era, captured Wilson's dilemma. Quote, "To embark on war was to launch oneself on an irresistible current sweeping into darkness." Unquote. Now the darkness was past, and Wilson was determined that it never happen again. Wilson was obsessed with his responsibility for having sent his countrymen to war and felt a haunting covenant with the dead. "If ye break faith with us who die," World War I poet John McCrae wrote, "we shall not sleep though the poppies grow in Flanders fields." Wilson would keep the faith. But humanity responds quicker to hatred and opportunity than for peace for its own sake. Civilizations have profited immensely from wars, and warfare has progressed civilizations' expanse and technologies, not only for purposes of making war. Yet war has also turned out the light of civilization. Humanity has been set back centuries by its penchant for war, long periods of decline and retrogression, generations devoid of opportunity or hope. Wilson's purpose was to end these interminable cycles of darkness. The Versailles Peace Conference formally opened in Paris on January 18, 1919, with 70 delegates representing 27 of the victorious powers. The Germans were excluded until the treaty was ready to submit to them. Unfortunately, the drafting of the peace treaty was marked by violent conflict between the victors, who treated the conference as a brawl over spoils and acted as if their main purpose was to punish Germany for starting and losing the war. The problem that eclipsed all others at Versailles was to quickly restore the productivity of a world impoverished by 4 years of war. The war's aftershocks were felt all over Europe. Hunger, cold, short-lived communist uprisings in Bavaria and Hungary, pogroms against Jews in Russia, emergency food sent to the Balkans and the Middle East. The Paris peacemakers acted as if these problems were unrelated to them, as if they were saving civilization by redrawing maps instead. Germany, even prostrate, was still potentially the greatest producer of Europe, which denied its industry and energy had little chance of swift recovery. Greedy for land and treasure, determined to exact revenge, the great powers never gave Germany the chance to undo the damage it had initiated in the only manner it really could. Although Wilson's first point had insisted on open covenants openly arrived at, quote-unquote, the conference was crippled by secret treaties that poisoned the cooperation that might have prevented the greater butchery of World War II 20 years later. Hardly anyone had the sense to realize the Versailles Treaty's punishment of Germany was so iniquitously cruel that it would ultimately precipitate the Nazi counter-revolution that caused the next war. The secret treaties between the other Allies triumphed over Wilson's 14 principles because they were vehemently defended by their perpetrators. While Wilson took the high moral road toward world peace, the Allies gorged on the decayed corpse of the Central Powers, breaking up the Austrian-Hungarian Empire and grabbing Germany's overseas colonies. By impressing an onerous peace upon Germany, the peacemakers continued the war by political vengeance and ignored, in S.L.A. Marshall's words, quote, history's moral that war is mere butchery unless it gives rise to a more stable peace. But Wilson, perhaps because the final responsibility for dispatching the soldiers across the Atlantic Ocean was his, truly believed America's purpose should be a crusade for lasting world peace. Unhappy with the peace treaty that came out of Versailles, yet hopeful U.S. participation would moderate its harsh features, Wilson became its most ardent salesman, particularly for his beloved covenant for the League of Nations. Wilson returned home in July 1919, convinced the Senate, which under the Constitution decides upon treaties made by a president, would be forced to approve this one by the mere fact of its accomplishment, and what he thought was the powerful influence of world opinion. He misjudged the temper of his political foes, who were already upset that he did not include any of them in the peace negotiations in Paris, and that he had not informed Congress of his proceedings. The first anyone on this side of the Atlantic learned of the treaty was through a leak by the Germans, who had purloined an earlier rough draft copy. If Wilson had been more conciliatory and less arrogant about the treaty, he might have seen it pass through the Senate with very few reservations. Instead, he refused any amending of it, perhaps rightly claiming that Congress could not change what a union of nations had decided upon. He was wrong. The struggle over the treaty regressed into a partisan brawl because Wilson Democrats and Senate Republicans, led by Lodge and a handful of irreconcilables, quote-unquote, who opposed the treaty in any form. This Senate of 1919 retained bitter memories of Wilson's attempt to pack it with Democrats the previous election year, yet he still might have got the treaty passed if he had made a few compromises early in the fight for ratification. Wilson attempted to appeal to America's not entirely justified sense of itself as a compassionate nation. He emphasized the duties of a strong nation, and in 1919, as it was later in 1945, the USA was the most powerful in the world. It must not act as a master, but as the servant to humanity, Wilson said. He called the Treaty of Versailles a great peace, the crowning achievement of my life to sign. It was, he said, a people's treaty, the first of its kind, a Magna Carta for labor and for women and children. It was, he said, the great humane document of our time. Above all, the treaty contained Wilson's cherished covenant for the League of Nations. The League did not guarantee there would not be any more wars, Wilson said, but it made war violently improbable by setting up elaborate arbitration and a cooling-off period that was the equivalent of a normal pregnancy. Wilson believed the U.S. had an inescapable moral obligation to bear its share of the responsibility for world peace, and he was certain that a great majority of Americans favored the League of Nations. To that end, balked by the Senate, which he spurned, he took the treaty to the people. In September 1919, he made a whistle-stop campaign across the continent to save the Covenant. He covered 8,000 miles and made 36 prepared speeches and numerous impromptu talks from the back of his presidential train in less than a month. Wilson aroused tremendous enthusiasm in the West on his whirlwind tour, a huge reception in Seattle, along with a review of the Pacific Fleet. In Portland, he spoke to thousands after an automobile trip along the Columbia River Gorge, during which a news reporter was killed in a traffic accident. Cars were parked all along the road, and he was cheered all along the route. The tragedy is that his exhausting appeal to the voters was a disaster. The people could not vote for the treaty. Only the Senate had the power to accept or reject it. Wilson should have stayed in Washington and worked it out with the senators. Instead, in Pueblo, Colorado, he suffered a minor seizure, and the rest of the trip was canceled. Back in Washington a few days later, he collapsed from a stroke that incapacitated him and eventually resulted in his death 5 years later. On November 19th, 1919, the treaty was rejected by the U.S. Senate. Another try the following March was also defeated. The League of Nations was officially born January 10, 1920, though the Assembly met for the first time in Geneva, Switzerland on November 15, a year after the United States declined to become a member. The League foundered from the start and was never able to curb powerful aggressors or to protect its weaker members. It was never a well-balanced supranational league and proved unable to enforce its decisions or deal with the economic problems that led to worldwide depression in the 1930s. By the time World War II began in 1939, the League had lost all prestige and influence. The League of Nations was crippled from the start by the defection of the United States, which broke the coalition of Allied power that might have kept the peace. Instead, the other nations responded to parochial fears and avarice and hardened their revenge against Germany. France, in particular, was stunned by the U.S. rejection of the treaty, and having already been attacked twice by Germany in the previous half century, enacted extremely cruel measures against its ancient enemy, which included a disastrous invasion of the Ruhr in 1923. The impossible burden of reparations on Germany economically unsettled Europe for more than a decade and contributed to the Great Depression, and also helped prepare for the rise of Adolf Hitler, which curtailed the reparations. Lloyd George blamed the failure to keep the peace on the Allied powers, who did not fulfill the intentions of the Treaty of Versailles, and probably never had any intention to. And now, a reflective tribute to the Veterans Day side of the brass coin by Rick Rubin of Portland. Veterans of America, I salute you. Annually, on November 11th, it is our duty as patriotic citizens to honor American veterans of all our wars, the brave men and women, whether the clerk typist in Korea or expert infantrymen in Kansas, who have actually or potentially defended our American way of life. Personally, I feel this day is one of the more significant of our American holidays, and each year I try to pause and remember one or more specific groups of veterans. I say specific because there are more than 25 million veterans in the country who, together with their immediate families, make up two-fifths of the population. You can't salute them all at once. A person needs something more concrete. For example, one group I delight in honoring is the veterans of the 25th U.S. Infantry Regiment, parentheses, colored, six of whom had won the Medal of Honor in the Philippines. On August 3rd of that year, a dozen or so members of this organization, angered by the treatment they had received from the white citizens of nearby Brownsville, Texas, made what has been described by white people, at least, as a shooting sortie into the town, killing one citizen. Whether any man of the 25th Regiment had ever been killed by the citizens of Brownsville, I can't say, but I am reasonably certain that no one had ever been convicted of doing so. The soldiers returned to their post unobserved, and during the subsequent official investigation, not one of the 160 men of the three colored black companies would inform on his fellow soldiers. On November 5th, President Theodore Roosevelt discharged, quote-unquote, without honor, every man of the three companies, observing that if no one admitted guilt, all of them would have to pay the penalty. The discharge without honor meant all pensions and payments were forfeited, including those of the six Medal of Honor winners, and none of the men was ever reinstated or given a pension. And so each year, I salute the veterans of Brownsville. Would it be so unsophisticated if I salute the first Americans to die under Hitler's bullets, to be blown to heroes' graves by Mussolini's airplanes? American veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade of the Spanish Civil War, I salute you on Veterans Day. I salute those other unlucky veterans, communists and socialists, German-American Bundists, the homosexuals and psychotics, and other disreputable types who were drafted into the Army in time of war and were then, though not actually convicted of any crime, discharged under circumstances less than honorable to hunt for jobs as best they knew how. I salute the veterans of Coxey's Army, who in 1894 marched on Washington, D.C. to petition for relief legislation and bonuses for veterans, but were instead rushed by guards, shot and injured, and saw their leaders arrested for the crime of tramping on the grass. And I do not forget to honor the World War I Veterans Bonus Army marchers of 1932. Several policemen were injured while evicting them from vacant government buildings where they were living, and in the process killed two of their number. The Army was called in by President Herbert Hoover and led by General Douglas MacArthur, advanced in full battle dress with machine guns, tanks, tear gas, drawn sabers, and fixed bayonets. General MacArthur observed the marchers were animated by the essence of revolution, quote-unquote, and further commented that if President Hoover had let it go another week, I believe the institutions of our government would have been severely threatened, unquote. So to be fair, I salute not only the Bonus Army of 1932, but also the soldiers who attacked them and subsequently became veterans themselves. And further, I salute Veteran General MacArthur. I salute the Negro combat troops of World War I who served with French divisions overseas so as not to cause trouble and won many citations for bravery under fire. Perhaps the only veterans of our history who not only had to learn foreign weapons and foreign military organization, but even a foreign language just to serve their army in time of war. And I further salute some who returned home from World War I and were among the 70 Negroes, several still in uniform, who were lynched during the first post-war year. Even if they had learned uppity ways from those alien Frenchmen, they were American veterans, nonetheless. Of course, the first veterans I hail each year are my own comrades in arms of the Korean police action, quote-unquote, who, if they were less than totally successful as soldiers, were less successful still at draft dodging, although many no doubt now march in the parades of November 11th. Then I move on to the other defenders of the American dream, the Nisi members of the 442nd Infantry Regiment and the 100th Battalion, who voluntarily joined the Army out of concentration camps across California, Idaho, and Utah, won five distinguished unit citations with the 5th Army in Italy and the 7th Army in the Rhineland, and are said to be the most decorated regimental combat team in American history. Then they returned home to such places as Hood River, Oregon, to find the American Legion did not want a bunch of lousy Japs repossessing their lawful homes and farms. The government they had served voluntarily and well was prepared to pay depreciated 1945 prices for their cars, equipment, and other possessions confiscated in 1942. I salute the American Legionnaires who castrated, hanged, and then shot full of holes one Wesley Everest from a railroad bridge near Centralia, Washington on Armistice Day 1919, and thereby defended the American way of life against the eight-hour day and other such foreign-inspired, wobbly, IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, Union, demands. I salute as well a man who, as colonel, shared with Ethan Allen leadership of the expedition that captured Fort Ticonderoga in 1775, who later that year led the capture of the fort at St. John's, and in 1776 almost captured Quebec, who attacked the British on Lake Champlain with a fleet of leaky small boats, and in 1777 repulsed an attempted invasion of Connecticut, who was wounded in the thick of fighting at Saratoga while leading his troops to victory, who commanded Philadelphia in 1778, West Point in 1780, and went on to become one of America's best-known veterans. Colonel Benedict Arnold, I salute you. I hail Private Edward Donald Slovic, called Eddie, one of thousands of American soldiers convicted of deserting in the face of the enemy during World War II, but the only one since 1864 to be executed for doing so. On January 31, 1945, he was shot to death by a firing squad and rushed into veterandom. I salute, too, the veterans of U.S. military actions other than declared wars. Hawaii, 1893, China, 1900, Panama, 1903, Dominican Republic, 1904, Nicaragua, 1911, Mexico, 1914, Haiti, 1915, Mexico, 1916, Dominican Republic, 1916, who got just as dead, wounded just as painfully, but by some oversight, got no GI Bill, no homecoming parade, no veteran special bonuses, or even so much as a casualty statistic in the World Almanac. I salute the men who fought to destroy the dictatorship in Cuba, the anti-Batista fighters, now no more able to get a good job than those earlier anti-fascists, the men of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. I salute the Bay of Pigs invaders, who, if they weren't either Americans or in the American Army, at least took our pay and did our work, however unsuccessfully. I salute the former officers and men of the Revolutionary War who participated in Captain Daniel Shea's rebellion of 1786, an attempt to overthrow the government of Massachusetts, also called the Whiskey Rebellion. I salute the veterans of the Revolution who knew it was right and proper for a people to throw off the shackles of an unjust government. And I salute the men of the Union Army in the Civil War who knew that it was wrong and unlawful for a people to throw off the shackles of an unjust government. I salute American veterans who invaded Latin American countries to protect them from outside intervention, then invaded them again to intervene on behalf of American property rights. In fact, I stand ready to salute any group or individual veteran who fits my peculiarly warped view of defenders of the American dream. I salute those first Americans to die for their country, the American Indians. I salute those pilgrims, Puritans, and Protestants who killed them and were killed by them and thus became the second Americans to die for their country. I salute the soldiers, sailors, and airmen and women in Vietnam who died for some country, I am not quite sure whose. Nor do I slight the American boys in the Congo, in Korea, in Formosa, Spain, and Morocco, nor the military advisor groups in dozens of, or perhaps even hundreds of other countries, all dying, or at least ready to die, without benefit or declared war or GI Bill of Rights in defense of freedom and the local USI S. Library. Veterans of America, myself included, I salute you. And that was Veterans of America, I Salute You by Rick Rubin, who is a Portland artist and writer. This article was among the best of The Realist, printed by Running Press of Philadelphia, and was originally published in Realist 71, November 1966. And now, as epilogue. A close friend from the Vietnam War has died. His name was Cliff McKenzie, and he was the first of those I knew best who was sent into combat. Both of us were Marines, which probably seems coincidental that this Sunday, being the USMC's 244th birthday, and Monday, Veterans Day, aka Armistice Day 101. Mac's family plans a wake for him on these memorial days, mirrored by a black wall with 55,000 names of Americans who did not survive the war. McKenzie and I were both USMC grunt reporters. Infantry combat Marines were our beat, and it was a mobile beat, Shank's mare through paddies, jungles, and villages, though we were often pinned down by ambush or snipers, or simply stopped until helicopters evacuated dead or wounded Marines, luckless to be a sniper's target, or blown apart by a mortar round or booby trap. Every Marine I knew in Vietnam ardently desired to survive Vietnam and live to old age and die in bed back home in the USA. Now, several decades and the passing of not only a previous century in which the war was fought, but an entire millennium disappeared into perpetuity. We surviving survivors, our old age, and are tottering off to join our friends who have been haunting us since they left us swaddled in body bags. The last time I saw Cliff McKenzie, which was the first time since Vietnam 40 years earlier, was when he and others who had meant the most to me when we were in country, quote unquote, came to Oregon 11 years ago to reunite with me after my mother died. We spent part of a day of our reunion in a downtown Portland hotel. The lobby swarmed with Vietnamese-American high school and college students from all over the USA who were attending a weekend seminar at the hotel intended to acquaint them with the history, customs, and traditions of the ancestral homeland their families fled a generation earlier. It seemed mockingly ironic for us Vietnam veterans to be surrounded by the U.S.-born offspring of refugees from a country we had helped devastate in an iniquitous war. Another irony was that the young Vietnamese Americans were excited to meet an aging group of Vietnam veterans. Perhaps a happy irony might be that one of those young Vietnamese Americans might one day be president of the United States. This is Michael McCusker, hoping my use of public radio as a carrier pigeon in tribute to a dead war comrade might be forgiven, and remember Armistice Day as an end to war. Just ask a veteran.